My name is Jamila, and I'm a medical student at Barts, a medical and dental school here at Queen Mary's University in London. I want to specialize and become a consultant in obstetrics and gynecology, and that requires a very particular area of study, but for almost every medical student in the UK, the first year of study is pretty much the same. And one of the things we all do at some point during that first year is something called prosection. Prosection is sort of like dissection in that you're dealing with dead bodies and stuff, only instead of dissection, where you're chopping up an entire body, prosection is when the dead body has already been chopped up by an experienced anatomist so that medical students can study its anatomical structure. About three times a year, we'll put on our white coats, along with a pair of goggles and latex gloves, and then we'll head down into the basement where all the cadavers are kept, and study specific parts that are laid out on those big metal tables. This is basically like a circuit of looking at each organ or body part for about 10 minutes before moving on to the next. It's definitely one of the grimmer things we do during the first year of medical school, and if you've even got an ounce of squeamishness in you, one or two prosection sessions are enough to squash that out of you. So a couple of days after my second prosection session in first year, I received a generic email from a department head stating that all prosections would be cancelled for the foreseeable future. I didn't really take much notice of it. My next session probably wasn't going to be for another few months, so I figured it wouldn't apply to me. But that wasn't exactly the case, because a few days after I got the email, I got a knock on my room in the halls of residence, and when I opened it up, there was a female police officer stood in the threshold. She very politely explained that the halls of residence had given the Met police permission to search my room, but she wanted to be polite and asked if I minded if a few other officers called by in the next half hour or so to have a little look around my room. Obviously, I had nothing to hide, and my room was like the size of a cupboard, so of course I consented. She thanked me and moved on, before two other officers called by a short while later, only this pair had a sniffer dog with them. Like I said, I had absolutely nothing to hide, so I just stood there politely while the officers ran the dog around the small interior of my room. It had a little sniff around, I mean for like 10 seconds tops, then they too thanked me for my cooperation and then moved on, but not before I asked them if they could tell me what was going on. One of the officers apologized and told me they weren't allowed to talk about it, but they were sure the university would mention something to us soon enough. Only, they didn't. Weeks went by, and we were pretty much left to just assume that, since there was a sniffer dog involved, that the whole police search was because someone in the halls was suspected of drug dealing, or at least having drugs in their room. Students and drugs go together like a horse and carriage, so assuming it was something drug-related, it seemed perfectly logical. But we were wrong, because the real reason the rooms were searched was far darker, and considerably more disturbing than just a few bags of weed or something. Now, I can't actually confirm this, and I don't have any solid evidence for what were essentially rumors that went around, but someone apparently high up in the anatomy department went off the record and told a student that the cancellations of the prosection sessions and the sniffer dog search were linked. Apparently, someone had stolen a specimen from the basement during the session I was in. It was something that had happened once or twice over the years. Someone had pilfered a preserved heart or a skull, but in this case, an entire head had gone missing from the basement, and the potential for scandal was phenomenal. None of this ever ended up in the papers or in the news, so many of it was just rumors that couldn't be confirmed. But I also heard that Barts was forced to make a huge out-of-court settlement with someone that same year, and that a non-disclosure agreement and high court injunction had been put in place. Honestly, that could have been over literally anything, student misconduct or some other kind of scandal, yet I can't help but connect the dots from the rumors and the search to the payout and the injunction. I really do think someone stole a human head from the basement somehow. But whether or not it was a student or a member of staff, I'm not sure. And why ever anyone would want to do that is just beyond me. I'm really not sure I want to know why someone would want to steal a preserved head from an anatomy lab, or what they'd do with it once they did. It's also pretty frightening that Barts seemed more concerned in covering things up and sweeping things under the rug than really getting to the bottom of what happened, or keeping us informed. I'd considered doing more digging if the whole thing didn't leave such a bad taste in my mouth, and like I said, the whole thing raises questions that, if I'm honest, I'm not sure I really want to know the answers to. And so I just have to live with it. Live with the fact that one of my fellow students could have stolen a human head, hid it away somewhere, and are now using it for some truly sickening, perverse things. Okay, so little side note here. Has anyone else noticed how nice the weather has gotten since the lockdown started? God, it's been so frustrating. Shut indoors while the weather went from gray and windy to warm and sunny like, well, must have been a matter of days. In all my life, I've honestly never seen spring slam into winter with such a dramatic transition. It's been tough on my little girl, too. She's been dying to get out to the local park to play on the jungle gyms, and telling her no, not to mention explaining why, has been harder and harder as the weeks have gone by. I can't tell her the truth because I knew it would absolutely terrify her. Breaking down, there are little creatures living inside of us, waiting to be transmitted to someone she loves like Pap-Pap or Nana, which could end their lives. How do you even say that to a child without them totally freaking out? So, our story starts with bird watching. I know, boring, but try telling that to my daughter. She burned through all her DVDs and favorite YouTube channels in like a week, and despite some of them having palpable rewatch value to them, she quickly grew tired of staring at a screen for hours on end. It got way, way worse than we started having to tell her no about going to the park. Seems like once you hold something out of reach of a kid, it's all they want from then on, the forbidden thing. I found a happy compromise with her, in that if she stayed inside, she could look at the garden all she wanted. And the bonus was that if she stayed super still and quiet, that all kinds of birds and other critters would wander into the garden for her to look at. And you know what? It actually got kind of fun after a while. I actually fished out an old native birds of the upper American East Coast that I'm pretty sure was my grandpa's at one point, and we got to work ticking off each one we saw. Working our way through the book as common and rarely seen birds alike landed among the flower beds of our backyard. One evening, I'd swear I saw something larger moving around the trees at the back of our yard, but I figured it was just a trick of the light. Maybe a neighbor's dog moving against their back fence, casting shadows into ours. But a few days later, I discovered it wasn't just my imagination. I was doing some laundry upstairs while my daughter busied herself with birdwatching. I'd ordered a cheap pair of kids' binoculars from Amazon, and those things really had paid for themselves by the evening of the day they arrived. My kid was obsessed with them. She had them practically strapped to her face for the entire day, looking at everything and anything up close and being amazed at the results. So she was only happy to sit in front of the patio window doors and will away the hours by checking out the wildlife at close range through her new binos. And thank God, because having to keep an eye on her day in and day out was meaning housework was mounting up, and at the top of the list was laundry. So I'm working through piles of dirty clothes, calling down to her every so often to see how she was doing, and everything seems to be going fine. Every so often I'd rush down when she claimed to have spotted a new kind of bird in our garden. Often I'd have to point out that it was one we'd seen before, but once or twice we actually locked eyes with a lesser spotted woodpecker, a bird we most definitely hadn't spotted before. Only when I heard her cry out, "Kitty," I figured she must have gotten kind of bored of watching for birds. At first I was a little worried. The last thing I wanted was for my little girl to witness a full-on bird murder in our own backyard, but I was quietly reassured by the fact that all the neighborhood cats were fat and spoiled and they wouldn't be finessing at backyard birds anytime soon, that was for certain. Suddenly I heard a kind of thump against the window doors like my daughter had hit her hand against the glass super hard. I called down to tell her not to hit the glass as it would scare all the birds away and they might not come back to visit. Her answer made me drop the laundry basket and hurtle downstairs. "I didn't. It was the kitty." But that thump was loud, bigger and louder than anything a simple house cat could make. It was so weird to write back now, but I distinctly remember just not thinking at all. Just sort of flying into action. This white-hot urge to protect, protect, protect. Just turning me into more machine than woman. And what do I see the moment I turn the corner into the living room? I see my daughter, standing at the glass doors, staring at an actual mountain lion in the face. The huge cat had its paw half-cocked, as if I didn't already have an idea that it was the one making that banging noise against the glass. I ran toward my little girl with such speed and aggression that the mountain lion jumped back for a second. The inherent danger of the situation, danger that she seemed to be completely unaware of previously, caught up with her and hit her like a freight train. She started bawling, screaming, realizing in a white-hot moment that Kitty didn't want to play. Kitty wanted to rip and tear. That the kitty wasn't a kitty at all. Once it realized I'd taken away its intended prey, the mountain lion took a few more swipes at the glass and only rushed out the backyard once I started banging pots and pans together real loud, just like my grandpa had showed me years before. I guess this was just a long-winded way of saying to keep a real close eye on the woods and green spaces when this lockdown is over. It might not be entirely safe for our kids to be playing in places that have obviously been reclaimed by wildlife, and dangerous wildlife at that. A few months back, I decided I was pretty much over the breakup I'd had during the summer with my long-term girlfriend. It took me months to be able to get over it, as I was really heartbroken, but at some point you just sort of have to get back on the horse, don't you? So I downloaded that dating app Hinge and started swiping through profiles. It's definitely the best dating app I've come across, as it lets you actually message girls directly instead of just sort of hoping that they're going to see you and match with you. So it definitely gave me a better chance at getting to talk to the kind of girls I'm into, and one of these was a Persian girl named Sarushe. Sarushe was honestly one of the most beautiful girls I'd ever laid eyes on. She had this big mess of wild dark hair that was dip-dyed blonde towards the ends, really high cheekbones, perfectly sculptured eyebrows, and some of the deepest, darkest, most alluring brown eyes I'd ever seen. She was simply stunning, and because she'd grown up in Tehran, the capital of Iran, I had something of an edge. You see, I speak a little bit of Farsi, the language they speak there, and I figured that might impress her if I told her as much, which it did, and boom. Only an hour or so later, I sent her my opener and we were chatting. She was an extremely busy person, and I was flattered when she said that she would make time to see me. So, we arranged to meet for coffee over the weekend. She showed up to our date in her gym gear and apologized for being so underdressed, but could only make it after a scheduled workout with her personal trainer. But I didn't care at all. She looked absolutely smoking hot in her yoga pants. And we were having coffee, just kind of chatting about our lives, our interests, all that first date kind of stuff, when I look out of the big glass windows to see this dude leaning up against his car. I thought it was my mind playing tricks on me at first, but after a minute or two I realized that he was just straight up staring at us. At one point, Sarushe noticed me looking over her shoulder and asked what I'm looking at, and I make a comment about the bloke outside who seemed to be proper eyeballing us. She then turns around, looking over her shoulder, then spins back with this terrified look on her face before saying something like, "We have to leave, now." I'm all like, "Why? Do you know that fella?" And she denies knowing him, but I'm not a dope. I knew what the score was, like straight away. Either it was a controlling family member or something, or it was a psycho ex-boyfriend. I figured all he'd do was follow us to try and be intimidating or something, but I never imagined he'd actually lay hands on me, and the way that he did it absolutely scared the soil out of me. You see, where I live is built up along this big mile-wide river, and the coffee shop me and Sarushe had chosen to meet at was right on the docks. So we're walking along the city's promenade when the guy cornered me, grabbed me by the throat, and started pushing me backwards so my back was leaning over the rails. I tried to get him off, but this bloke was an absolute unit, and as much as I tried, there was no getting him off of me. And the thing about the river where I live is that it's got a really, really strong current. Like if you fall off of a boat or over the side of the prom, you can be in serious trouble as the current will suck you under the water, drown you, and then just drag you out into the Irish Sea. So the whole time he's threatening me, telling me to leave Sir Ashay alone, all this big macho masculine stuff. Sir Ashay is smacking him around the head, telling him to get off me, and all the while I'm thinking, if I go over the edge here, I'm a dead man. And I don't think he had any idea of it either, like it didn't sound like he was from our city, as we have a very particular accent, which he just didn't have. So he was probably thinking he could lash me in the water and embarrass me a wee bit, and I'd just be fine, but I'm telling you now, I wouldn't have been, and he'd have been done for manslaughter. But thank God, he didn't throw me over the railings, he just sort of backed off and headed back the way that he'd come after he'd blown off a little bit of steam. I mean, the girl was gorgeous. I don't blame him for being a bit sore after a breakup or jealous of another lad, but Jesus Christ, if he'd been angrier, if he'd have lost his cool, really lost control, I legit wouldn't be here typing this. I'd be floating in the Irish Sea somewhere, maybe washing up as a rotten corpse on the beach in County Cork, all because of some idiot getting a bit jealous. You might be able to describe 17-year-old David Faraday as the all-American boy. David was clean-cut, a good student and a member of the Boy Scouts of America. He was also apparently something of a moral arbiter, having once confronted a marijuana dealer outside of his high school when the man had apparently been attempting to peddle the drug to members of the student body. After threatening to inform the police, the dealer was said to never have hung around the high school again. And although by today's standards we might consider this to be so-called snitch behavior, David was clearly simply trying to protect his fellow students from something he was concerned would affect their academic performance. He was a good person, with a good heart, and almost all of what he did came from a place of love. But like many boys his age, David found himself increasingly interested in the opposite gender. And there was one particular young lady that caught his attention over all others. Betty Lou Jensen was 16, a year younger than David, but she was incredibly popular and her reputation as a charming, well-mannered young lady preceded her. She was also a very talented artist who took a great deal of interest in all things creative. It was at a local youth function that David got the chance to talk to Betty Lou, and his affection for her seemed to be entirely reciprocated. Betty Lou shared a great deal with him and even invited him to visit her after school so that he could walk her home. After a few weeks of wholesome teenage dating, something of a relationship began to blossom between the two bright-eyed young people. But all was not entirely well, as there was another boy who had his eye on Betty Lou, one who was not about to let David have her all to himself. He squared up to David when the young man was waiting outside of Betty Lou's high school. And although the confrontation didn't become physical, some pretty harsh insults were exchanged and David was warned to stay away from his new girlfriend. Other boys might have been deterred by such a display of possessiveness and aggression, but not David. He was determined to secure his place as the only boy in Betty Lou's life, and so one afternoon on their way home from school, David asked Betty if she'd like to go on a date with him, their first date. And to his absolute elation, Betty Lou said yes. David racked his brain for a solid first date idea, and given that it was late December, decided that a great way to capture that festive romantic spirit would be to take Betty Lou to a local Christmas event. And being the gentleman that he was, he made a promise to her parents to have her back home by 11 p.m. at the very latest. Rumor has it that David and Betty were planning on attending the Christmas-themed party with a few other local high school students. But perhaps this was simply a cover to reassure the young girl's parents, because what we know for certain is that they ended up driving over to Lake Herman Road in David's Rambler station wagon, parking it up in quite a well-known spot that was known to many as Lover's Lane. The whole appeal of the spot near Lake Herman is that it was quiet and unfrequented by members of the public, hence why young couples might use it to gain some privacy for certain unsavory activities. But it wasn't just infatuated lovebirds who noted the location's seclusion, because someone else wished to take advantage of the isolation for something that was considerably more malicious. At some point during their stay up on Lover's Lane, David and Betty Lou noticed another car pull into the spot, one that parked up alongside them before turning its lights off. At first, David and Betty were worried it was the cops, come to arrest them for committing lewd acts in public. But as they peered through the darkness to study the vehicle next to them, it became increasingly obvious that it was not in fact the police. All the young couple could do was watch, growing increasingly scared as the shadowy silhouette in the front seat stayed statue still, staring at them through the passenger's window. Betty Lou told David she was spooked and asked him to see if he could get the person to leave, but unlike previous encounters where David's bravery had shone through when confronted with a source of maliciousness, he too was far too frightened to do anything. But as he prepared to start up the Rambler's engine so he could drive Betty Lou out of there, the driver of the other vehicle got out and approached David's side of the Rambler. David was transfixed, frozen in fear like a deer in a car's headlights, but when he saw the mysterious stranger pull out a pistol and aim it at his window, his flight response kicked into gear. Betty threw open the passenger side door, throwing herself from the Rambler before David followed suit. But neither kid was fast enough to outrun a bullet. The stranger fired once through the roof of the Rambler, then sprinted around the back to fire another shot at David through the vehicle's rear window. Both shots hit the young man, and he crawled along the ground near the station wagon's back wheel on the passenger side, trying and failing to escape. Betty Lou, however, began to sprint away through the darkness as the first shots were fired, but the stranger was fast. He took aim and fired 5 shots at the right side of her back, each bullet striking her torso before she fell. As she lay dying in the darkness, the killer turned his attentions back to David, pointing the pistol towards his head and pulling the trigger one last time, sending a bullet crashing into his skull just behind his left ear. Apparently, the killer then simply got back into his car and drove away into the night. Sometime later, someone who drove past the spot on Lover's Lane must have seen the bodies lying in the dirt, and then rushed to call the police. David was still breathing when they arrived on the scene, but was completely unresponsive, and was dead on arrival when he was finally taken to a nearby hospital for treatment. The double homicide stunned and horrified the local community, and rumors abounded that there was a crazed, firearm-wielding madman on the loose, with it only being a matter of time before they struck again. One of the first people contacted by the police as a potential suspect in the murders was the young man who had confronted David as a result of his own jealousies over his and Betty Lou's blossoming relationship. But it was discovered that this young man had a strong alibi for his whereabouts, meaning there was no way he could have been the mysterious, bloodthirsty stranger who pulled into Lover's Lane that night. As the summer of 1969 drew to a close, journalists and law enforcement alike wondered if the teenage lover's killer would ever be found, but little did they know that the nightmare had just begun, and what would follow would continue to baffle all those involved for decades to come. Because the man who took David and Betty Lou's lives that evening, the man who relentlessly fired bullet after bullet into the Rambler station wagon, would come to be known by a name that would echo through the annals of true crime all over the world. The Zodiac. Zodiac's identity remains a complete mystery even to this day. The killer's nickname originated from a series of taunting letters and cards sent to the San Francisco Bay Area Press. These letters included 4 cryptograms based around a number of ciphers, one of which was recently solved by the FBI after over 50 years of research and study. We know for certain that the Zodiac murdered 5 people in Benicia, Vallejo, Napa County, and San Francisco in the 11-month spanning December of 1968 and October of 1969. It seems he preferred to target young couples, which is how he seemed to have come across David and Betty Lou while the pair were on their first date. Yet despite only 5 confirmed victims being attributed to the Zodiac, he once claimed to have murdered 32 other people, bringing his total body count to 37 victims. a killing spree that started with two young lovers, so excited to finally have some time alone together on their first date, never being able to imagine that it would end in such a brutal moment of painful finality. So the next time you're on a first date, don't be so quick to go somewhere secluded, as you never know who might be watching or following, just ready to turn a perfect romantic moment into a living nightmare. Crisp detail, and it freaks me out to this day thinking about what could have happened if things turned out differently. School was out for summer, and I had convinced my mom to send me to Russia for a couple of months to visit my grandparents. We moved to North America when I was little, and I hadn't been back much since. Plus, I thought it would be fun being on my first trip abroad by myself. She agreed, and off I went on my first solo transatlantic journey. My grandparents are great people and have always spoiled me and my mom rotten, and they were ecstatic their only granddaughter wanted to visit, so they planned a little vacation of their own with me a month after I arrived to a popular beach resort city in Turkey. We were to stay at a 5-star resort in Ankara for 2 weeks. I thought that was spectacular, getting to travel to not one, but two countries in one summer, and to a fancy exotic place like Turkey. I was dying to go. But, full disclosure, when I arrived in Russia, it wasn't really what I was expecting. My grandparents are really protective people, and I couldn't do much or go anywhere by myself, so it got boring pretty fast, and I spent most of my days playing PSP in my room. I was also accustomed to being active and wanted to do things like go jogging, which I did every day at home, so I gave my grandparents a hard time about this since they wouldn't let me go alone, and naturally they couldn't really keep up. Then after about a month, the time came to go to Turkey, and I was super excited to finally get some freedom and a change of scenery. I had been pent up at home too long. The resort they had picked was sprawled over a pretty large area. However, it was all very well secured and isolated from the rest of the city, and there was also a huge garden on the property which was ideally suited for jogging. This time, I had my own room separate from my grandparents, so I took this chance to go off by myself and explore the grounds. Most of the time, I would go jogging in the mornings when it was cooler with my big old iPod, so I couldn't hear anything that was going on around me, but I figured it was pretty safe since it was a nice hotel with plenty of tourists. Then I started to notice him. A pretty innocuous-seeming gardener in his late 40s, early 50s, in a green uniform. I remember he looked like a shriveled old date from too many years in the sun. He would always wave or say something in broken English as I passed by while he trimmed the shrubs or mowed the lawn. I would politely wave back, smile or nod, but I didn't really pay much attention. Fast forward about 10 days, and I was really enjoying myself. It was fun to swim in the pool and the sea, the food was great, and my grandparents had let up a lot so I could do more by myself. However, they didn't know about my morning runs in the gardens, and I wasn't going to tell them because I wasn't sure they would approve. So one morning at around 7 a.m. while I'm jogging, I see the gardener again, but this time it's clear he's trying to get my attention. He waves at me and yells something, so I stop and pull out my earphones, trying to figure out what he wants. Now, I know he works for the hotel, so I don't really suspect anything. He waves at me again and motions me to come forward. I'm confused, but I figured he wants to tell me something, so I politely approach. He's standing at a trail that goes deeper into the gardens and foliage. He's smiling and gesturing, and I can see he's holding something in his hand. "Rosa," he says. "Beautiful Rosa." Then I notice he's holding a rose and extending it to me. At this point, I'm confused and a little freaked out about what he's thinking, but I stay put. Usually the hotel staff there are chatty, but nice enough. My grandparents would always get pulled into conversations with him about things. I figured it's something like this now, and I don't want to be rude, but still want to be on my way without offending the old man. He hands the flower to me, and I take it, thinking maybe he wants to show me some roses that are in bloom, but he keeps waving and gesturing, like he wants me to follow him, and stupidly, I walk closer. He has another flower in his hand, and he backs away more. Then suddenly he stops and starts to lower it a little. That's when I notice he's holding his other hand behind his back, too, and he's holding something. I look ahead up the trail and see a little cabin-type thing where I assume they keep their gardening supplies. Something clicks in my head then, and I instantly back away. He sees me do that and tries to smile, saying, "Rosa," again, and moves the hand he's holding behind his back while lurching toward me. That's when I see he's holding some kind of rag. Without hesitation, I drop the rose he handed me, turned around and run for it at full speed. I don't stop to look back and run like mad back to the hotel. It's not until the doors close behind me and I'm among other people that I look back and see if he's followed me. I don't see him anymore and my heart is beating like crazy. I go back to my hotel and wait for my grandparents to wake up. I never told them any of what happened that day and spent the rest of my vacation glued to their side. I thought that if I'd said anything, they would get even more paranoid about my safety and blame me for wandering off on my own. Also, I didn't want to ruin the remaining days for them. I saw the gardener once more on the beach. I remember him talking to a security guard. I remember growing very uncomfortable and sinking into my sun chair when I saw him. Then he looked at me and smiled. I scowled at him as he mouthed the word Rosa tauntingly and smiled again. I still remember the anger bubbling in my stomach and how much I wanted to cleave his face in, but I just froze and stared. He walked away and I went back to pretending nothing ever happened. Needless to say, I never went on any more morning jogs, and neither did I want to until long after the summer had ended and I'd returned back home. When I was about 16, I went on a trip to Cabo San Lucas with my family and my best friend. My friend and I had a hotel room to ourselves for the trip, something I was naturally excited about. One afternoon, I was getting on the elevator and a security guard got on with me. As the elevator rose, he looked at me and said, "Excuse me, were you wearing a green skirt on the beach the other day?"
Yes, why?"
I replied. I was already reflexively creeped out at the mention of a miniskirt I had worn a few days prior.
"Oh, nothing. I just really liked it a lot."
When I got out of the elevator, he got off on the same floor and was walking past as I took out my key card to unlock the door to my room. At 4 a.m. that morning, I woke up with a startle, only to register that there was a man standing silently at the foot of my bed, a man in a security guard uniform, the one from the elevator. As he saw me wake up, he stammered something about my door not being locked properly and ran out of the room. I was still groggy with sleep and didn't fully register what had just happened. A moment after he ran out, I became aware I was lying on my back with covers around my ankles. I sleep nude, but never kick my covers off in my sleep as I was always cold and the AC was on full blast as well. I'm also a very deep sleeper, so someone standing at my bed alone would never stir me. I'm pretty sure him pulling the covers back, causing me to get cold, is what woke me. I am scared to think what could have happened had my friend not been fast asleep in the next bed. Unfortunately, as I was creeped out in the elevator and had avoided making eye contact or looking at his face, and as it was so dark I couldn't have identified him in the room, I never bothered to report it to the hotel. I still regret that, years later.